The boy's mother, Mrs. Thomas Croft, now turned the car around and headed for Honolulu. Huge explosions mushroomed up on their right. Thoroughly frightened, they stopped the car and ran into a cane field. There they sat for the next 2 hours, hands over their ears, heads between their knees. Whenever a plane flew by, Mrs. Croft would ask one of the boys to peek up and see if it was American. It never was. Everyone had a different idea of safety. Mrs. Gerald Jacobs, another Pearl City Navy wife, stopped her car and stuck her head in a roadside bush, literally like an ostrich. Mrs. James Fisher stayed indoors, just as her husband told her to do, but only for so long. She suddenly put on her winter coat, ran out of Navy Housing Unit 1, and began hitchhiking to Honolulu. A family friend saw her and gently led her back to shelter. Mrs. E. M. Eaton joined a group of friends who zigzagged madly down back roads to the Mormon church. They took along the things they thought would come in handy. Mrs. Joseph Coate picked up a loaf of bread, a can of tuna, but no can opener. Mrs. Arthur Gardner carried a blanket, a can of orange juice, a butcher knife, and Pinocchio. She and her two children then joined several other families in a small railroad ravine behind the junior officers' duplex quarters. Pinocchio proved a good idea, and the mothers took turns reading. Occasionally there were interruptions, cheers when a plane crashed, or an uneasy glance at some low-flying strafer, then back to the book again. As they read, they all did their best to keep a calm voice. Once some Hawaiian-Japanese canefield workers came running down the railroad track toward the little group. Everyone was sure the local Japanese had captured the island, and this was the end. Mrs. Gardner grabbed her butcher knife, ready to fight for her children's lives. But the field hands veered off and hid in the cane, equally terrified that they were going to be massacred by an aroused white population. The local Japanese had heard rumors, too. Early in the day, the story spread that the army planned to kill them all. Later, this was modified. The army would kill only the men, leave the women to starve. There had already been some close calls. 5 Japanese civilians had an especially narrow escape walking down a peaceful country road far from the fighting. They were spotted by Seaman George Sicken and several shipmates who were bringing a truckload of ammunition from Lualuale Depot to Pearl Harbor. The driver stopped the truck, and one of the sailors wanted to shoot them all. At first, the others more or less agreed, but suddenly someone said, "We are not beasts. These people had nothing to do with the attack." The men sheepishly got back in the truck and drove on. During the entire incident, not a word was spoken by the 5 Japanese. It was in this atmosphere that a young Japanese named Tadao Fuchikami, wearing a green shirt and khaki pants, chugged up to Fort Shafter on a 2-cylinder Indian Scout motorcycle at 11:45 a.m. Fuchikami was an RCA messenger, and this morning his day had started as usual. He punched in around 7:30, killed a little time, then picked up a batch of cables waiting for delivery. The cables had been put in pigeonholes, according to district, and Fuchikami just happened to take Kalihi, which included Fort Shafter. He thumbed through the envelopes to plan his best route. One of his first stops should be the doctor on Vineyard Street. The one for Fort Shafter could come later. There was nothing in the envelope that indicated priority. It just carried the two words, "Commanding General." As he started off, he was already aware of the war. The operator had said something about planes dogfighting. He could see the anti-aircraft burst over Pearl. He knew it was the Japanese. But war or no war, he still felt he had his regular job to do. This morning it was slow going. The traffic was a nightmare. Then as he headed toward Shafter, he ran into a National Guard roadblock. They advised him to go home, told him they almost mistook him for a Japanese paratrooper. This was quite a jolt. Fuchikami hadn't realized how much his messenger's uniform resembled what the parachutists were supposed to be wearing. From now on, he felt very conspicuous. Next, he hit a police roadblock on Middle Street. Only defense workers could get through. He rode his motorcycle on the sidewalk up to the barrier, showed the police his Shafter message, and they finally let him pass. When he got to Fort Shafter itself, he surprisingly had no trouble at all. A sentry waved him right on in. He drove straight to the message center and delivered the cable. The message was decoded and delivered to the adjutant at 2:58 p.m. He saw that it reached General Short right away, who in turn sent a copy to Admiral Kimmel. It was a cable from General Marshall in Washington, filed in the Army Signal Center for transmission via Western Union at 12:01, 6:31 a.m. Hawaii time, and received by Honolulu RCA at 7:33 a.m., just 22 minutes before the attack. It said that the Japanese were presenting an ultimatum at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 7:30 a.m. in Honolulu, and helpfully explained, "Just what significance the hour set may have, we do not know, but be on the alert accordingly." Admiral Kimmel told the Army courier that it wasn't of the slightest interest anymore and threw it in the wastebasket. He could have better used a message saying what the Japanese were up to now. They had disappeared completely. No one seemed to have the slightest idea where they had come from or where they had gone. At first, Kimmel thought they probably came from the north. He had always felt there was more possibility of an attack from the north than from the south. At 9:42 a.m., he even radioed Halsey on the Enterprise that there was some indication of enemy forces to the northwest. But soon all the information ran the other way. At 9:50 a.m., SyncPAC reported two enemy carriers 30 miles southwest of Barbers Point. Already maneuvering in the area, the Minneapolis knew it wasn't so, tried to scotch the report by radioing no carriers in sight. The message came through two carriers in sight. At 12:58 a.m., four Japanese transports were reported to the southwest. At 1 p.m., an enemy ship 4 miles off Barbers Point. A bearing on a Japanese carrier, which had briefly broken radio silence, could be read as coming from either directly north or directly south. The interpreter figuratively tossed a coin, called it directly south. Recalling that two Japanese carriers had recently been detected at Kwajalein, Admiral Halsey played a hunch that fitted in nicely with the meager intelligence available. He began concentrating his search to the south and southwest. The ships emerging from Pearl Harbor did their best to chase down the leads. When a message arrived reporting the enemy off Barbers Point, Admiral Dremel hoisted the signal, "Concentrate and attack." There weren't many ships to concentrate, just the St. Louis, Detroit, Phoenix, and a dozen destroyers, but they all dashed bravely forward. They, of course, found nothing, and as they steamed on to join Halsey, they were themselves identified as the enemy by an Enterprise scouting plane. This generated more reports pointing to the southwest, some of which were relayed to Admiral Dremel. Without realizing it, his ships were at one point searching for themselves. The air search was having no better luck. At first, the only planes available were some old unarmed amphibians based on Ford Island. They belonged to Utility Squadron 1, which performed chores like carrying mail, towing targets, and photographing exercises. Nothing else could fly, so they had to be used, but it wasn't an appealing assignment, even after rifles were provided for protection. "I want 3 volunteers, you, and you," Chief G.R. Jacobs told 3 of the squadron's radiomen. Aviation radioman Harry Meade soon found himself airborne in one of the planes. They had no luck, but they did establish that the Japanese weren't lying off Oahu. It made no difference. The rumors rolled on. The Army couldn't get up any search planes in the early stages, but by mid-morning, Major General Frederick Martin called Pat Wing 2 to put some bombers at the Navy's disposal. That was what he was meant to do under the Army-Navy plan for cooperation. Nobody would give him a mission. But General Martin heard somewhere that 2 carriers were south of Barbers Point, so he sent out 4 light bombers at 11:27 a.m. They found nothing. Then he sent some other planes a few miles to the north. They didn't find anything either. That afternoon, he made 1 more try, this time at the Navy's request. He sent 6 B-17s to look for a carrier that was rumored to be 65 miles north of Oahu. They, too, found nothing. On Ford Island, 9 of the planes just in from Enterprise were still undamaged, and Ensign Dobson rushed to get them in shape. Each one was loaded with a 500-pound bomb, and tank trucks stood by to gas them up. The pilots waited at the command center, swapping experiences and joyfully greeting latecomers who trickled in from forced landings all over the island. Lieutenant Dickinson arrived, having hitched 1 last ride, this time in a launch from the Navy Yard. He was surprised at the way men who had never been particularly close now fell on one another's shoulders. One senior officer, who had always seemed a crotchety martinet, threw an arm around Dickinson and even produced a nickel, calling, "Somebody go and get this officer a cup of coffee." It was great while it lasted, but Dickinson also noted that within a couple of days, relationships were back to normal. By 12:10, the planes were ready, the pilots climbed in, and Lieutenant Commander Halsted Hopping led them on a flight that scouted a wide sector 200 miles to the north. The right direction, but by now just a little too late. As they returned to Pearl late that afternoon, the sun blazed unmercifully on Ensign Dobson's face. He was dead tired, and it made him so very sleepy. He tried to concentrate, but his mind kept drifting off. Could it be, he wondered, that this day was just a dream, that when he got back to Ford Island, he could go home to his family after all.